This is the Infotagem podcast, the vaccine to the disinformation virus. New technologies make it easier to create deep fake films, where the image of a famous person can be successfully distorted to put them in a situation they've never been in, saying words they never said, or being portrayed maliciously to deliberately try and damage their reputation. In the fast-moving world of social media, a fake film could be seen by millions before it could be proven that it was fabricated. In 2019, a manipulated fake film was published of the Speaker of the House of Representatives, Nancy Pelosi, supposedly making her sound drunk at a press conference. With the general election in America in November this year, will we see more of this kind of disinformation affecting the campaign? I'm Damien Collins, and I'll be joined on this podcast by Nina Schick, author of Deep Fakes and the Infopocalypse, What You Urgently Need to Know, and Giorgio Petrini, the CEO of Deep Trace in Amsterdam, a company which develops technology for detecting and monitoring misuses of synthetic media, also known as deep fakes. We'll also be hearing from our resident disinformation analyst, Dr. Charles Creel. Firstly, Nina, it's great to have you with us on the Infotagem podcast. And we're very, very excited about your new book. Can you tell us why you particularly decided to focus on the role of deepfake films as part of, well, I think, what you call, and it's such a great word, the infopocalypse?
Yeah, I mean, I have a history, well, my background is in political advisory, and I've been particularly looking at kind of Russian information operations against the West for the last kind of 5 to 7 years. And it was against this context when I was advising a group of global leaders, including the former NATO Secretary General and Joe Biden, the VP currently running for president in the US, when I first heard about deepfakes. It has barely been 3 years, this is about 2.5 years ago, when they first emerged on a dark place on the internet and Reddit. And that's when I first saw how AI could be used to make really sophisticated fake films. And the first kind of use case and has been in non-consensual pornography. But with my kind of politics hat on, seeing the crisis of mis and disinformation, which we currently face, you know, what I've called the infocalypse, I knew that this was just going to be the next evolving threat in what has already become a very corroded, untrustworthy, and dangerous information ecosystem. Of course, the added urgency of this was that this was coming just at a time when video has become the most important medium of human communication. And it's still a medium that most people trust as true and authentic when it's not in the films. So this coming at a time when people are consuming ever more video, when our information ecosystem has already been damaged by bad information, I knew would be a very important threat, not only for politics and geopolitics, but indeed for everything, including personal lives. So that's how I first came to deepfakes.
Yes, and we've started to see some examples in the political world. I think in particular last year, there was a lot of attention focused around the Nancy Pelosi film, which was distortion of her voice to make her sound like she was some way impaired. And we saw very different responses from the big tech companies, the big social media companies to that. I mean, do you think companies like Facebook and YouTube take the threat of deep fake film seriously enough?
Well, deep fake has become something that's become, you know, quite a buzzword in a way for threats against democracy and how disinformation and the dangerous information ecosystem does undermine our political sphere. So because deepfakes are still, you know, they're quite sexy because they're just so sophisticated and we still haven't seen the heights of sophistication they will reach. I think that the tech companies at least have been making a good show and a dance about deepfakes. And if you look at kind of what Facebook has done along with Amazon, some of the other tech companies, they even launched earlier this year, this deepfake detection challenge where they they launch a competition where they try to get researchers to submit their own techniques for using AI to detect deepfakes. So yes, tech companies have been doing things on deepfakes because from a PR perspective, for them not to be doing something about deepfakes would be a disaster. Nonetheless, if you look at it holistically, if you look at the entire problem of mis and disinformation in the round, it's not only deepfakes which are coming that are going to pose a serious threat. They already pose a serious threat, but there are a lot of less sophisticated fakeries and disinformation, so-called cheap fakes, that are proliferating right now. You mentioned the Nancy Pelosi video, which happened last year. Just a few days ago, there's been another manipulated video of Nancy Pelosi where she, again, is made to look drunk, where she slurs her speech. It's not AI generated, but it's still a very sophisticated piece of disinformation. So they have they been doing enough there? Well, I think the question is, a lot of people would say they haven't. And I think the bigger problem is that, as I mentioned, the ecosystem itself has become so corrupt that we can't just expect kind of the tech companies to monitor it for us, although they play a very important role in what we do about it.
I think it's a really interesting area, because when we have this whole debate around disinformation, one of the challenges that's made, not unreasonably as well, how does this sit with people's free speech rights? How do you arbitrate on whether speech is true or not? And I've always felt you've got to have a very tight definition of what disinformation is, and that it has to be sort of things that are completely fabricated. But in some ways, deepfakes are one of the purest examples of this at play. And surely it can't be within someone's free speech rights to disseminate a totally fabricated film of someone else, and to do so for malicious purposes.
Absolutely. And on the surface, it sounds fairly easy to regulate. Nonetheless, I mean, the complication is that many people will argue that deepfakes or synthetic media, I kind of define deepfakes as the malicious use of synthetic media, but many people argue that synthetic media offers tremendous potential for the creative industries, for the film industry, for the gaming industry. So who are we? Although it's true that that AI-generated piece of synthetic content has been completely fabricated, I think what's very important to determine is its intent. Has it been used as disinformation? Has it been used as misinformation? And that's, of course, when it gets very, very tricky, because somebody can make a synthetic piece of content which is not meant to be used maliciously, but it can be miscontextualized, it can be clipped, it can be spread with naivete, even without a malicious intent behind it. And I think that's where it becomes tricky to arbitrate which synthetic content is okay and which is not. And I would actually hesitate against saying that all kind of synthetic media should just be banned. I don't think that's the way we should go. I think the best way in which we can approach this is more that I believe that the cat is out of the bag, and that in future, synthetic media is ubiquitous. The future is synthetic. I think the best defense we have is one of inoculation. The public needs to be made aware that this technology exists. It needs to be made aware of its use cases now, what the potential use cases are in the future, how quickly this is happening. And then I think that is probably need to go hand in hand with a policy approach. But I don't think the approach to deepfake should just be banned outright.
Well, I think that's right. And also, deepfakes will have a form in terms of satire, and some people will say it's a form of humor. In some ways, it's already existed, people pretending to be something they're not in order to satirize something. And I don't think we want to regulate that. But I think, as you say, it's the intent behind it, and certainly malicious intent, that we want to do something about. But I wanted to just bring in Giorgio at this point, because I think it also raises a question about how easy is it for people to identify these films, particularly if they increase in sophistication to a level that it's very difficult to spot a deep fake from a real film. So how do we do it?
It is a matter of technical capabilities. So it, as it is always mentioned in this context, we are working against a moving target. What I mean with that is if we were trying to understand how to create algorithms that can identify deepfakes on videos or on photos or on synthetic audios as well, with what can be produced today as a synthetic creation, it wouldn't be a very difficult problem. This is doable. It is actually, you know, it is doable. It is what we do with our company. The problem is comes when you start to imagine what an attacker, so from another side, what a bad actor could do tomorrow, in 6 months, in 2 years' time. What would be the skills that they have? What would be the technology available at the time? The question is, how can be sure that in the long run we still are able to understand inconsistency at pixel level, read the noise patterns from a camera that look artificial versus something natural, and so on? This is a difficult question to answer today. And I think also when we look back at the recent competition that was sponsored by Facebook and others, that was a great experiment in a scientific sense to demonstrate that the problem is hard when we try to think of what an attacker could do against us that we are not prepared to face today. So actually creating algorithm that can give you guarantees to respond and to be able to detect manipulation of videos and images in the long run is very tricky. And probably we cannot do it once for all. So I don't think there is really a silver bullet to solve this, technically speaking. But I have, you know, more two positive answers on this. One is this is actually literally what everybody does in security overall. So if you're talking about cybersecurity, what you want to do is being able to detect what an attacker could do today to harm you know, yourself, your company, your customers, your government, and so on. And proactively research on what's going on online in underground communities, what are the new tools that are available online in the dark web, for example. How can we actually intercept bad actors that are planning to create new tools, selling their services, or are maybe literally about to create a new video that are going to put on 4chan or on Facebook. So actually the intelligence part, that is also something that we devote a lot of the time in my team, is crucial here. So it is not about being able to solve the problem once forever, because technically this might not even be feasible. You want to understand, though, what is the next move of an adversary, what and how can you counter it and potentially prevent it, which would be, you know, the best way. So it's no silver bullet here, unfortunately. But I, on a positive side, I think that's literally what happens in any other area when we talk about cybersecurity or even national security. You want to model your attackers on the other side and trying to anticipate their moves.
Sure, but I think if we could just sort of, I always think it's interesting to try and explore what might be technically possible or what we can do now. And from what you're saying, it sounds like it's possible to look at a piece of content that's been created and from the makeup of that piece of content, determine whether this is something that has been made from lots of different bits that have been put together, or was something that was, you know, filmed in it as a single piece. And that may give you clues as to whether that is it's a deep fake or whether it was an original piece of content. Is that how you would go about doing it?
Yes, that's I think a great analogy that I find sometimes is maybe with ballistics. So we have always seen those movies where a detective want to understand if a particular projectile, like a bullet, comes from the same gun that somebody, some other criminal have used in another case, right? So this is really like a good analogy to understand. Give me an image, or, you know, a set of images or a set of videos. It is possible today to tell a particular model have created that face, assuming that you have knowledge of that model. So if you know, if that model, for example, is easy to access or is maybe even open source online, it is possible to understand retrospectively, or in a way reverse engineering that image, and understand that it was produced by a particular model that synthesizes images, versus that image has been instead captured by a camera. This is due to the fact that cameras as well as models that synthesize images leave a very specific fingerprints at pixel level that although we are not able to see because they are, you know, statistical pattern that are not very visible at in the semantic, in the understanding of the image for us from our point of view as humans, you can actually create algorithms that would highlight those patterns. And finally, you can actually point back to what was the most likely generator of that image. Was a particular camera model, you know, by this brand, given this configuration of the lenses and so on, versus AI, a generative model, actually synthesized that. So this is already possible today. And in many occasions, for what we see today in terms of deepfakes or fake faces of individuals that do not exist that are used online, we can actually say those things already. Yes.
So in terms of what's possible now, if take an election, take say the American election this autumn. So you'd say you could the machine could learn to spot maybe films that could be fake that feature the faces of candidates in that election, and could flag within the system that this is likely to be a fake film maliciously created about a political figure who's a candidate in an election, and therefore, you know, if they chose to, say a social media company could act on that at an early stage when that film was being shared. Is that something which is possible today?
Let's say it is not a binary answer here, right? So it is with good approximation, it is possible today to train algorithms to do exactly what you're asking for. So given an upload of a new video from a social media user, can we actually say with a certain probability that the face of those individuals in the video have been manipulated somehow? Maybe their identity has been swapped, or maybe they are saying and moving their lips in a different ways with respect to the original video. So to some extent, we can understand if that's the case. It is never going to be a yes or no answer, since you know, all this technology based on machine learning will always give you a probabilistic answer. But it may already be you know, very certain the model that you would apply at upload time may be already very certain that something have happened maliciously. Well, let's say we cannot reason about intent, but we could say that the video has been manipulated. Fact is, it is also entirely possible to imagine a situation that is the case where maybe a state actor have developed their own technology to create fake videos, and they have also studied the type of detection algorithm that, say, one social media have implemented as a filter to stop deepfakes on their platform. In that case, maybe the social media is not up to the game, is maybe one step back to being able to detect those very specific type of manipulation that have been adversarially studied against them. So the point is, if those type of manipulation, those type of algorithms are known to the community and there are studies, it's very likely that are detectable. It doesn't necessarily cover all the cases, and maybe the very targeted, as it could be a state actor, case of a lab that has never published the algorithm. We don't know about it. It's some secret lab in the basement somewhere. That may be much, much more difficult to do. But then also reconnecting to the point that you were making with Nina as well, intent is also an issue that is not solved here, because even if we had a perfect algorithm, it would always be able to tell us and flag us if this video is a deep fake. It doesn't necessarily mean that it is a malicious one. So then it's about the policy, the policy of the social media company to decide maybe this goes to human review, or maybe it goes just as flag as a manipulated. The fact is, knowing that a video is manipulated doesn't necessarily mean it should be censored on the platform or filtered out, just because we don't know what is its intent. And an algorithm, unfortunately, cannot do that for you.
No, but it would seem that you could create a system where something was flagged for human referral at an early stage of it being shared, and therefore, if it was fell outside of the policies of the platform, someone could do something about it. Because, I mean, one of the fears has been raised in the past is, you know, will it always be easy to tell at least whether this is manipulated or not? And then once you've got that information, you can then make a decision about what you do about that film. Yeah.
Exactly, and I think it is indeed what is happening as first a attempt on some of the social media platforms at the moment, at least for what we see from the outside. I think fact checkers or internal people that would look into health of the platform in a way from against information operation and this kind of attacks. That's what I would review. The plus of having an algorithm is given the huge amount of videos and images that are uploaded every day on social media, at least this can be this can filter out and submit to human analysts only the most contentious type of media that are believed to be, you know, red flagged to be checked. Otherwise, obviously, it would be a lost game if it was all in the hand of fact checkers. So that's really what the technology can do for essentially filtering out the massive amount of media that would be otherwise pointless to review manually.
And just finally for me on this, do you think the cost of entry to this is falling? I mean, often when technologies develop, as the price of making, say, a deepfake film falls, or the ease and time it takes to do it, we'll likely see more of it. And do you think that is starting to happen now?
Oh, yes, so definitely. So we have monitored this space in the last 2 years or so, and we have definitely observed a cost and a decrease in terms of creation services or even just the amount of tools that are available online. So I think the last figures that we have seen, it really depends on the type of photorealism that you would like to achieve with some of this creation, obviously. But there are tools that, if you know how to use them, they are for free. They are open source, and all you need is some coding experience, some basic understanding of deep learning, maybe. Although there are lots of tutorials that would explain step by step how to create those. And finally, it's just a matter of having a GPU, a graphic card on your desktop. So in a way, if you know what you're doing, you can actually create them very, very cheaply with very limited computer power. But if you're actually asking to somebody else to do that service for you, there are marketplaces where those prices are discussed. And often we intercept those conversations, and it can go from just, I think the last I've seen is $10 per minute on a deepfake, which would be, you know, a low quality one, maybe, up to, if you go for more professional services, it could cost maybe $10,000 for a few minutes of deepfakes. So that would actually fool most people that have never heard of deepfakes. So in a way, even if you go in a very high end type of creators, it would be still a pretty small budget considering how many people could actually watch this video and, of which their opinion may be, polluted if you dump this on social media. So definitely cost is decreasing because more and more creators are actually trying to sell their services.
Great. And Charles, it's great to have you with us again on the podcast.
Oh, thanks, Simeon.
You're following our conversation about deepfakes. I'd be interested to hear your thoughts on that, and also whatever else has caught your eye in the last few days.
Oh, thanks. Well, I've got a few questions, actually. Really, listening to both of your conversations, I find myself wondering how much of a model is Photoshop and still photography for this. There was quite a moral panic about this at the beginning of the 90s. Yet here we are, there are Photoshopped images everywhere. But photojournalism hasn't died.
Yeah, I think that's a really interesting question, Charles. And I don't think anyone is insinuating that, you know, video journalism is going to die. It's just that the effects of being able to fake video will have a huge impact, because by and large, I mean, you talk about Photoshop, right? 1990, people still look at the cover of a magazine, and Photoshop is ubiquitous. I mean, it's not even Photoshop. You can edit photos quite easily now.
Use the Face app
or anything on your phone. But people still look at the cover of a magazine and look at the model and think, oh my God, she's perfect. I would love to look like that. And we don't, you know, this is 30 years after the invention of Photoshop. So I think the important thing is that at a time when, again, I go back to this point, video has become the most important medium of human communication. If you look at how many people in the world, including those who are digitally illiterate, now consume video. I think by next year, it's estimated that 82% of internet traffic will be on the consumption of video and video downloads. We're still not used to the idea that video can be corrupted. And I think you're very, very right to raise the point that throughout human evolution and history, our information ecosystem and the way that we communicate has always been changed by technology. However, the pace of change has always been a little bit slower and something that society has been able to catch up with. So if you look at the printing press to the invention of photography, there's 400 years in between, right? And the invention of the printing press, we know, changed the course of history. The Reformation wouldn't have happened without the printing press. And yet, what's happening now is that these technologies are coming together so quickly. If you look at the last 30 years, from the internet to social media to smartphones to now the coming age of AI, all of these exponential changes are completely transforming our information ecosystem. And I think the important point here is that we are just not able to keep up with the pace of change. And that's why I think at this moment, the fact that video can now be subverted is just so important.
If I can add two words on this, I absolutely agree with Nina's point. Maybe to rephrase it, what we like to call this phenomenon in a way is the commodification of these technologies. That's, I think, the important factor that really differentiated from other, as you said, the Photoshop era. So we are at the time where some of those technology, say the face swap over videos, or say the creation of fake faces that are used then on profile on social media to spread this information in groups. I see many of those. Those are literally into consumer apps that are free most of the time, or are actually accessible on the web browser just by refreshing the page. You get as many images as you want. So for some of these tools, the barrier of entry is so low that actually they don't require any technical skill to operate. Even more, the potential volume in output, meaning how many of those pictures you can create given a day of work, is actually unlimited. So you could create a thousand and thousand of those without paying any service and without having any technical skills, which is, I think, what really puts this far away from the potential harm of somebody using Photoshop. Photoshop is still probably used in most cases when people want to start up fake news article, modifying some picture from the past to put somebody in a situation out of context, like a politician. Still, you will need somebody having access to Photoshop and know how to use it. And at the end of some hours of work, there will still be only one picture. Today, we can generate maybe 1,000 of those. I think that's the difference.
So with the mass availability of the tools and more people having a skill set and an ever-lowering skill set required, what are we going to find is more dangerous in video deepfakes? Is it going to be malicious state actors? Someone in their bedroom in Romania trying to make money, or a bunch of kids on 4chan?
Well, I think it's not mutually exclusive. And in my book, I kind of divide up the kind of areas or the arenas of danger, because one arena of danger goes to the very, very macro level when you talk about geopolitics. And both of you from your work will know about Russian disinformation operations going, from all the way back to the Soviet era to 2020. The fact that the these tools are developing at such a rate just means that information warfare becomes all the more powerful. So you have the geopolitical arena, then you also have the domestic arena. And this is happening all the time in our Western democracies, again, as both of you will know well, where disinformation is now being spread by Western actors. And then beyond that, and this is what Giorgio really looks at Deep Trace, Giorgio I interviewed for my book as well, you have enterprises and businesses who are also going to find that they now need to have a risk mitigation strategy for disinformation in the era of deep fakes. And then it goes all the way down to the individual. And this is really, again, where we've seen the most malicious and first use case of deep fakes in non-consensual pornography against women. Yes, there are celebrities, but there are also normal women being targeted by anonymous people creating deepfakes, and as Georgie already mentioned, through the increasing commodification of this technology through apps or through deepfake creators who you can find on a marketplace on the internet. So I think that, again, I come back to this point about the corrosion of the information ecosystem in which deepfakes are just the latest evolving threat. And it is just something that affects everything from geopolitics to private individual lives. And this is, I think, a reason why in the age of information, our crisis of information, mis- and disinformation has become one of the most important issues facing society.
And perhaps a way of closing off, I mean, we have a major election this year in America. How likely do you think we may see a major attempt using deep fake technology to try and disrupt an election with a fake film? And often the sort of scandal films in politics are, you know, often look sort of a bit grainy, like something someone shot on their mobile phone at a meeting or an event, where a candidate has said something which maybe they shouldn't have said. How likely is it, do you think we may see something totally fake like that launched in the last few days of a campaign to try and disrupt an election?
Well, we haven't talked much about the other side of the coin because we spent much of the podcast talking about the ability to create these sophisticated fakes. However, the other side of the coin is that if the technology is out there where this sophisticated fakery can be made, then everyone gets plausible deniability as well. You erode any objective truth, you erode the ability to come to any consensus. So although we have already been seeing around the US election the use of deepfakes, including by Donald Trump, who retweeted a GIF, which by my definition was a deepfake because it used AI to be created. And you've also seen the use of cheap fakes, so those manipulated videos of Nancy Pelosi. I think the more prescient danger this year is that something does emerge, something damning, and that a political candidate can then dismiss it as a deep fake. If you think of 2016, the nadir of Trump's campaign was when that tape emerged, the leaked tape, the Access Hollywood tape, when he bragged about grabbing women by the pussy. Well, if that leaked in this environment, Donald Trump could just dismiss that as a fake. Indeed, he's already been doing so. In 2016, he had to apologize for that tape and say it was locker room talk. But in 2020, he'll just say it's a deep fake. So the real risk of deep fakes comes from both sides. You erode any sense of objective truth and reality. And of course, we know that is a disastrous potential effect for democracy.
And this is like Steve Bannon's idea that you just flood the channel with garbage, and so nobody believes anything at all.
Absolutely. And this is also very much the ideology that governs Putin's Russia, right? So at the heart of it, there's a ideological, political imperative. You know, do we become completely cynical and we just submerge completely to the notion that there is no shared reality, there is no objective truth? And if we sign up to that, then everything else going forward in terms of our political and civil discourse is just information warfare because there is no truth. Or do we try to stop this? Do we try to, you know, close the floodgates and say, no, there is an objective truth, there is an objective reality, and that's how we govern our Western liberal democracies. And that's really fundamentally what's at stake here.
Absolutely. And that's a great point on which to bring things to a close. And I think it's been a common theme in so many of our podcasts, even though we've looked at so many different aspects of disinformation about COVID and about politics and other things too, which is the danger of living in a world where there is no objective truth and people just believe whatever they want to believe, and that the people that can flood the system most effectively with the things they want people to believe are more likely to prevail, regardless of whether what they're saying is true or not. But thank you, Nina and Giorgio. Thanks so much for joining us on the podcast. Charles, it's great to have you with us again. And thanks for a great discussion.
You've been listening to the Infotagem podcast, hosted by me, Damien Collins, featuring Nina Schick, Giorgio Petrini, and Charles Creel. It was produced by Lucy and David Dargahi. You can find out more about Infotagem, the independent COVID-19 fact-checking service recommended by Ofcom, and send us examples of disinformation you've seen by visiting our website, infotagem.com, or using hashtag IsolateTheLies on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. Thank you, until next time.